Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgan, your host for the show. Nearly half the public nursing homes in rural areas of Washington have closed since 2007. At one Eastern Washington nursing home in Tenasket, resident care manager Sandy Vaughn says closures and moves are hard on residents.
We had one resident who died shortly after the move because it was just too much of a change.
Rowan Moore Garrity explains how the North Valley Center is dealing with financial challenges common to many rural nursing homes. That story, plus how coastal communities are preparing for a major earthquake, how wind-powered vehicles may soon be a common sight on Washington's ocean beaches, and how everyone can ride for free today on Sunset Empire Transportation buses. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgan. This week marks the 315th anniversary of the 1700 magnitude 9 Cascadia earthquake. 315 years ago, a massive quake rocked the coast and a resulting tsunami hit thousands of miles away in Japan. Some say the West Coast is now overdue for the next big one. Planners in some communities have safe areas and evacuation zones and other emergency measures in place, but some communities are more prepared than others. Kristen Foden-Wenzel reports.
Mary Jo Curlin with the Lincoln County School District stands in the car park of the old Waldport High, just 12 feet above sea level.
As you look around, you can see there is no high school here any longer. It's been demolished. It was demolished in a learn to burn exercise with our local fire departments.
A short drive uphill is the new high school, complete with a cache of tsunami supplies. But how did that happen? Why, at the height of the recession, did residents of Lincoln City, Newport, Toledo, and Waldport come together to pass a $63 million bond? Curlin says one way was to promise a large slice of the money would be spent locally.
I have talked to contractors since then. I've run into them in the grocery store, and they say, thank you so much. The work the school district gave us helped us through a very rough time.
Rich Baloney, director of support services for the school district, says they also timed the bond to the sunset of another bond.
I was asked a lot of times, you're telling me that we will not have any new taxes, that they will not go up. And I said, that's what we're promising you.
Waldport also had plenty of high, flat land well above the tsunami zone on which to build. So now all 11 school buildings are out of the zone. It's the kind of success that other towns can only dream of. Take Seaside. It sits on a long, level stretch of land right next to the ocean. Seaside Superintendent Doug Doherty says 80% of residents live just 15 feet above sea level. Scientists say buildings there need to be on land at least 70 feet above sea level to be safe. Doherty says they tried to pass a bond to move their schools, but it failed.
We heard over and over again, shouldn't the state and the federal government, shouldn't they contribute to this? Because it is a huge lift for our community.
And again, any success at the state or federal level?
I wish I could say I was, but at this point, no.
That lament can be heard up and down the coast. The Democratic president of Oregon's Senate, Peter Courtney, said voters did approve a measure to spend up to $1 billion to retrofit essential buildings, but that was 12 years ago.
We've had a heck of a time trying to sell the bonds because they require the authorizations of the legislature.
About $75 million has been spent so far. Courtney says politicians have a hard time prioritizing something that only happens once every few hundred years.
Everybody wants to do something about it, but just not now. And I think, you know, that happens in life.
The other problem is that the money can only be used to renovate existing buildings, not to demolish them and build the replacements elsewhere. What all this means is that towns up and down the coast are trying to figure out things for themselves. Take Yahats. Frankie Petrick is the chief of the Yahats Fire Protection District. She says their station is 65 years old, only 20 feet above the sea level, and bursting at the seams. She says they're considering a bond to rebuild uphill, and they've already got their eyes on a spot. But it's right on the edge of the state's most recently identified tsunami zone.
Your toes will get wet, but not your ankles.
Seismologists say there's a 37% chance of a massive earthquake off the Oregon coast in the next 50 years. Meanwhile, the Oregon legislature is in session next week. Governor Kitzhaber wants $100 million for seismic projects. Senator Courtney wants to double that. I'm Christian Foden-Wenzel reporting.
Scientists say the Northwest is due for an earthquake and tsunami as big as the one that struck Japan nearly 4 years ago. That could spell trouble for fire stations, schools, and hospitals built with little or no seismic engineering. Reporter Ed Yon recently traveled to Japan. He visited one hospital there that survived the 2011 quake without so much as a broken window.
This is what a magnitude 9 earthquake sounds like. What you're hearing comes from a video shot inside the Red Cross Hospital in Ishinomaki, Japan, on March 11, 2011. Papers fall, doors swing wildly. What you don't hear is panic, and after 3 minutes, the shaking stops. Not a single window is broken. The lights are still on.
No staff were hurt, and none of the important medical equipment was damaged.
That's Dr. Iwao Kaneda, the hospital director. He's speaking with Jay Wilson, chair of Oregon Seismic Safety Council. This is Wilson's third visit to Japan since the quake. He's seen plenty of devastation, but the hospital is a success story.
You know, any number of aftershocks could have also shut that hospital down, but it didn't.
Other medical facilities were destroyed by the tsunami that inundated half of Ishinomaki City that day. The Red Cross Hospital, built in 2006 on a small hill, stayed dry. It was the region's only fully functioning hospital on March 11th. There's another reason this hospital survived, though. Hiraku Abe, a Red Cross engineer, ushers us down a stairway into the basement. The large space we enter is kind of like a concrete moat. At the center, the hospital floats on columns of rubber and metal springs. It's as if the five-story building is balancing on 100 massive pogo sticks.
This is pretty much geotechnical engineer, structural engineer. Let me start over, because the word I was going to say was porn.
That's Allison Perch, a geotechnical engineer with Seattle-based Hart Krauser. She says the springs are an example of something called base isolation. This kind of thing exists in the U.S., but it's not common.
This is super cool. This is not something that I've gotten to see before. This is not only base isolated, but the deep foundations here are 200 feet deep.
This hospital stood up to the fourth largest earthquake ever observed. Engineers say it can withstand several more quakes of equal size. That's a lesson Wilson, the guy in charge of Oregon seismic planning, wants to bring home, because right now, no building in Oregon meets this standard.
It's a powerful example of human ingenuity, of human adaptability, of human will to coexist with the natural environment. And, you know, why is it such a hard argument?
One reason is that the Ishinomaki Hospital cost $102 million, a price that would probably cause sticker shock in Oregon's coastal towns. Some Oregon communities have trouble raising money just to move public buildings out of tsunami zones, let alone pay for this kind of engineering. Still, the Red Cross Hospital remained standing at the very moment people needed it most. And that's the takeaway Wilson wants to bring back to Oregon, as the state debates how much earthquake preparation is worth.
In my mind, we can't afford not to do it. The payoff for that big hospital in Ishinomaki is it worked.
According to a 2012 article in the engineering journal Structure, Japan has more than 6,500 base-isolated buildings. There were only 125 across the U.S.
Oregon State Legislature begins the new session on Monday. Job number one, crafting the next two-year budget. In the last election, Democrats strengthened their majorities in both houses, and leaders say they want to boost education and other priorities that suffered cuts in recent years. Liam Moriarty explains.
At a recent lunchtime City Club event in Eugene, Democratic Speaker of the House Tina Kotek said lawmakers are poised to enact changes meant to give a boost to workers still recovering from the Great Recession.
I know that if the legislature does its work right, we can ensure a more level playing field for women and working families who don't just want to get by but want to get ahead.
Kotek said people who work hard should be able to pursue the American dream.
So we must do three things. In the legislative session ahead, we need to expand opportunity, we need to reward work, and we need to ensure fairness.
To that end, there are a range of proposed bills that would raise the minimum wage and mandate such worker benefits as sick time and paid leave. Democrats also plan to push forward with environmental initiatives such as the state's clean fuel standard. Representative Peter Buckley of Ashland says it's a matter of Democrats delivering on campaign promises.
We are going to govern on what we ran on, and I believe we're in sync with the values of the majority of Oregonians who have put us in office.
Buckley says the intention is to build on what he calls middle-class economics. That's a phrase President Obama used in his recent State of the Union address to describe his plans for strengthening the middle class, which has seen its fortunes decline in recent decades as income inequality has grown. Buckley says the burgeoning economic recovery nationally and in Oregon validates that approach.
The proof is very, very clear that middle-class economics do work, that the path to additional prosperity is an expansion of middle-class economics, not a trickle-down theory that says tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts lead to prosperity.
Buckley is the chief budget writer in the House. He and Senator Richard Devlin of Lake Oswego recently released a budget framework, sort of the legislature's first draft of the next two-year budget. It focuses in large part on continuing to restore the funding for K-12 and early childhood education that was lost to cuts during the recession. It also seeks to put money back into higher education. Buckley says the proposal would boost community college funding by 15% and the state's public universities by 22%.
Those percentages sound great. But what they're actually doing is getting community colleges and universities back to where they were in 2007 before the recession hit.
Buckley says quality education is key to rebuilding the middle class. But both Buckley and House Speaker Tina Kotek say while the current budget trajectory is restoring much of what was lost during the economic downturn, more money will be needed to make the kind of investments in education that would allow the state to excel. Lawmakers are reluctant to revisit the 25-year-old Measure 5, which curtailed property tax increases. But a variety of proposals for tapping the wealth of high earners and large companies are up for consideration. That concerns Senate Republican leader Ted Ferrioli.
It's a virtual tsunami of tax proposals.
Ferrioli says between taxes and new mandates such as paid leave and the clean fuel standard, Democrats risk killing the goose that lays the golden egg.
The first casualty will be capital formation in Oregon for new investment and business expansion of existing businesses, because those are the places where consumers will push back against business owners trying to recapture those mandated costs from consumers.
Further complicating the budget process is the growing possibility that, as the economic recovery increases state revenues, the kicker tax rebate mechanism will be triggered, blowing a possible $300 million hole in the budget. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
And that audio of Speaker Kotek was provided by KLCC Eugene. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, operators of wind-powered vehicles such as blow carts and wind buggies may soon be able to practice their sport on some Washington Ocean beaches. Some are enthusiastic about the proposed change.
It's a great way to just push kiting to the next level, to get some of the Oregon people up here. Just give us one more area in the off-shoulder season.
Others have reservations. We'll hear comments from a public meeting held last night in Ilwaco. That's coming up just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Patchy morning fog today, then partly sunny with brief sprinkles possible this morning. High temperatures today in the high 50s with northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then tonight, mostly clear. Patchy fog after midnight with overnight lows in the low 40s. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says partly sunny through Friday, even into Saturday. Saturday, the high moves off to the east ahead of the next front that will push in more clouds and a chance of rain Saturday night into Sunday. Rain is likely Sunday night. Then the chance of rain continues into Monday and Tuesday. Highs for the period in the high 50s, lows in the low 40s. As the population ages, nursing homes have been a traditional care option in the U.S. But with the continuing rise in health care costs, many nursing homes are shutting down. Rural nursing homes are particularly hard hit. Rowan Moore Garrity reports on how the closures have hit rural Okanagan Valley in Washington.
Nearly half the public nursing homes in rural areas of Washington have closed since 2007. Prosser, Davenport, Garfield County, Odessa. Tenasket's North Valley Nursing Home could be next on the list.
Year-to-date actual loss through October of $767,000.
That's CEO Linda Michelle going over the nursing home's books for 2014. She says the problem is simple.
Expenses rise, and if your reimbursement doesn't rise with it, you go in the hole.
State governments squeezed by the recession have also been shouldering an increasing share of health care costs through Medicaid. Nationwide, a recent study found a shortfall of nearly $8 billion a year in states' Medicaid reimbursements to nursing homes. Private facilities can stem their losses by capping the number of Medicaid beds and requiring higher-paying private insurance for the rest. Public nursing homes don't have that luxury.
We have to follow our waiting list. We can't say to you, because you're on Medicaid, we don't have a Medicaid bed for you.
At North Valley, 90% of residents pay with Medicaid. Take Daryl Coleman.
Hi, Daryl.
Hi, Andy. This is my territory, this hall. A beauty shop, barber shop. This is where we go get coffee.
Coleman moved into the nursing home 2 years ago. He used to live in North Valley's assisted living wing, but it closed because of similar financial woes. At 90, he says change is hard, even for the little things.
I finally got them to put an onion in my, whenever they give me a hamburger.
That took almost 2 years. Resident care manager Sandy Vaughn says other displaced residents fared much worse.
We had people who moved from the assisted living over here who physically became worse, were emotionally challenged. We had one resident who died shortly after the move, because it was just too much of a change.
Now, some residents fear the nursing home could go the way of assisted living. One problem is that as medical costs have grown, billing and accounting have become more complicated, too. Staff at small rural nursing homes have had trouble keeping up.
You can buy technical expertise, potentially. They may not, in many cases, have a budget to do it.
Gary Kelso is CEO of Mission Health, a nonprofit nursing home operator in Utah. He says that technical expertise is crucial in getting paid for the care you provide. Medicaid doesn't pay for everything. Each facility's reimbursement rate is based on hundreds of factors. Kelso says it's all about acuity, how sophisticated the treatment is.
Are they receiving restorative therapy? Are they receiving certain narcotics that require a nurse to manage it? And if they're not,
the reimbursement may be lower. Take a person who's wheelchair-bound or someone with dementia.
It may be very heavy staff time, you know, to make sure that they are safe and comfortable, but it's not sophisticated in the acuity sense.
Kelso specializes in rescuing small public nursing homes in financial distress. He says facilities like North Valley have a hard time keeping costs down. Wages and benefits may be higher than in the private sector, and many homes are overstaffed. Often, being tied to a hospital also means paying more for food and medical supplies.
Because, again, a hospital has a greater overhead, so if they're sharing the cost, they're passing that cost on to that nursing center based on their cost basis.
Nationally, nursing homes are consolidating to achieve economies of scale or being replaced by less expensive home and community-based care. But neither remedy will save public nursing homes in rural areas. If North Valley closes, the nearest open Medicaid bed could be more than an hour away. In Tenasket, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity.
Operation of wind-powered vehicles such as blow carts and kite buggies are allowed on Oregon beaches, but in Washington, users have been restricted to limited short-time special event permits only to enjoy the sport. Now the Washington State Parks and Recreation Commission is considering a rule change that would allow wind-driven carts and buggies to be operated seasonally and year-round in specific zones of Southwest Washington ocean beaches. A public meeting was held last night in Ilwaco to present the proposed rules change and to gather citizen comments. User groups have been asking for the change since 2008. Since then, limited use permits have been granted for special demonstration events. Randy Klein, environmental program manager for the Washington State Parks and Recreation Commission, said results of the special events were positive.
We held quite a few demonstration events over the course of 5 years. And as I mentioned, this really gave us an opportunity to observe the use and become more familiar with it. And what we found here at State Parks is these events occurred without significant conflicts or any incidents reported.
The most heavily traveled areas of the peninsula's beaches would remain off limits to the wind-powered vehicles. Vehicle users would be limited to specific zones within allowed areas. The three proposed limited-use areas on the peninsula are at Long Beach, South Beach, and North Beach, with some seasonal area use zones and some year-round area use zones. Holly Kemmer, Development and Events Director for the Long Beach World Kite Museum, said the rule change would be a boost to tourism in the off-season.
I think it's a fabulous opportunity. Especially here, we're such a great touristy area. It's a great way to just push kiting to the next level, to get some of the Oregon people up here, to, you know, just give us one more area in the off-shoulder season, because this really is a year-round sport, and it's got a huge following. So this would give us a huge opportunity.
The rule change would exclude environmentally sensitive areas such as snowy plover breeding grounds and limit vehicles to hard sand areas of permitted beach zones. But opponents say the rules don't guarantee protection of sensitive areas and would be difficult to enforce. Ann Skelton-Lafors, a citizen who attended last night's meeting, expressed some of her concerns.
I'm concerned primarily about the dunes and whether or not this use might infiltrate into the dunal area, which is a protected area. We already have people who illegally camp in the dunes. During 4th of July, we have a lot of that, all the way up down near Seaview and also, I understand, up around Clipson Beach. And these people use the dunes as their private bathroom. There's garbage. There's all sorts of issues. And I'm not saying that blowcart riders are going to be the same, but it just is another example of how we are loving our beach to death.
Public comment on the revised rule language will continue to be taken until February 6th. Then a SEPA, or State Environmental Policy Act review, will be conducted with a 14-day comment period. The full commission will consider the rule change at their March 26th meeting in Lakewood, Washington. Testimony will be taken there at a public hearing. Klein said if the rule change is adopted by the commission, it could take effect at the end of May. Project Homeless Connect takes place today in Clatsop, Pacific, and Wakayakum counties. The Clatsop event will be held all day at the Seaside Convention Center. One service provided today will be extended to everyone in Clatsop County. Free rides on Sunset Empire transportation buses. This morning in the studio, I have with me Jeff Hazen, director of Sunset Empire Transportation District, and we're going to hear about the Ridership Appreciation Day taking place today.
That's correct. Thanks for having me today, Kathleen. I'm excited to be here and excited about Rider Appreciation Day. We do this each year in connection with the Homeless Connect project, which is going on down at the Seaside Convention Center. And we look forward to helping provide rides to not only those people that are needing services, but also to everybody throughout the system. So if you're going on a route within Clatsop County, jump on the bus today. It's free.
Excellent. And people might not know just how many places they can get to by bus.
Oh, boy. Quite a few, actually. We have a route in Astoria that runs every hour. We have our Highway 101 route that goes down to Seaside every 2 hours at this point. And we have a Cannon Beach bus that circles Cannon Beach from Seaside every hour also. And then we go to Longview three times a day, I believe, on Highway 30.
And do you also connect with other bus services in our area?
Yeah, we do. A few years ago, a project was started called the Northwest Connector, and it's a consortium of five transit districts: Columbia County, Clatsop County, Tillamook County, Lincoln County, and Benton County. So we're all linked together to get people throughout the coast, the North Coast and Central Coast, to help with their transportation needs. The idea is to get people from the valley to come over, enjoy the coast, but ride the bus and keep your car in a parking lot somewhere.
Okay, in addition to the free bus rides today, we've also got something going on at the Transit Center.
Yeah, we're having an open house. This morning we have our board meeting, and then but during that board meeting you're welcome to come in and sit and enjoy the meeting. But we also have some goodies out in the lobby of the Transit Center that you can enjoy, and then once the meeting's over we'll shift the food and goodies and give away prizes and things inside the conference room and have a little bit more space to spread out things. So, but we'll be doing that all day long. So stop by and get a snack.
And the Transit Center is located?
On 900 Marine Drive in downtown Astoria.
And what are the hours for the free rides today?
It'll be all day long. All day long. And we run buses up until about 8 o'clock at night. So plenty of opportunity to jump on the bus.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hazen, for coming in today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and hope to see everybody ride the bus today.
And that is all for today's edition of The Bridge. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1. That's NEWS, then the numeral 1 at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.